He couldn't have gone from he couldn't have gone all the way from the bottom to the top. He had to have been slow enough for that kind of time, I think. Okay. Cancer, also known as oncology, or the study of cancer. So this is another form that in terms of a pathology to look at first. We will be talking about specific cancers when we get to certain systems, but we have to talk about cancer in general first. I've gotten in the habit now, because it's such a new area for you folks, is if I'm doing an area, like from here we're going to the integumentary system, first slide, I'm always putting definitions in. So any definitions I come across, I kind of load them into the first slide so that you can always go back if you see a word in the book or something. You'll find a lot of the common definitions here. I've also gotten in the habit of coming across a word, I may put in brackets a very short definition of a particular word if we haven't come across it before, as far as that goes. So some of the key terms when we're talking oncology is oncology itself, which is a branch of medicine that specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of cancer. It includes medical oncology, the use of chemotherapy, hormone therapy, and other drugs to treat cancer, radiation oncology, which is the use of radiation to treat cancer, and surgical oncology, which of course is the surgical interventions that are done to also treat cancer, whatever those things may be. How many people here have a relatively close experience with cancer in their family or loved ones, right? So you get the idea of how, you know, consistent this is. It exists around a lot. So an abscess, when we talk about an abscess, an enclosed collection of pus and tissues, organs, or confined spaces. An abscess is a sign of infection and usually swollen and inflamed. Ecchymosis is a small bruise caused by blood leaking from broken blood vessels into the tissues or under the skin. So that's a medical term we might use for a bruise. A benign is, anytime we see it, could be a benign anything, meaning it's not cancer. What's interesting, though, a couple things about benign tumors is, first, is they can get quite large and do have detrimental effects. It could cause compression on nerves or blood vessels or other tissues, but generally, or it doesn't, metastasize. So benign tumors don't leak out and go to other areas of the body and show up other places. An example of a benign tumor could be a lipoma. Everybody's heard of lipomas, I think. Have you come across lipomas in clinic at all with any of your patients? Anybody here come across? Okay, so it was like a ball of mass that you felt under the skin?
Yeah,
that, you know, the key point is it's movable, so you can grab it and shift it around. Some people suffer from them terribly. I've seen patients in the hospital who have hundreds of them all over their body. They look bumpy. They're quite bumpy all over the place, and they're just fat deposits. Malignant, of course, is a term used to describe cancer. Malignant cells grow in an uncontrolled way and can invade nearby tissues and spread to other parts of the body through blood and the lymph system. Metastasize is a cancer. It relates to cancer or malignancy, and metastasizing is to spread from one part of the body to another. When cancer cells metastasize and form secondary tumors, the cells in the metastatic tumor are like those in the original primary tumor. So we'll find similarities. This is what they do, is even to the point within the context of oncology, they may find a tumor in a particular area of the body, and it's usually unlikely that that part of the body gets a primary tumor, so they start looking back, right? So breast cancer has an affinity for spinal tumors and brain tumors, for example, right? There are primary brain tumors, but in terms of investigation, they may discover, they think that the brain or the spinal tumor is a secondary tumor, so they'll start looking in the rest of the body for the possible malignant tumor that's metastasized. Carcinoma is a cancer that begins in the skin or in tissues that line or cover internal organs, as we know as serous membranes or epithelial tissue. In situ, it means in its original place. For example, in carcinoma in situ, abnormal cells are found only in the place where they were first formed. They have not spread. So whenever you see that, it means it's not spread. It's where it started. Differentiation. So you're going to hear this a little bit. And it's the process where normal cells undergo physical and structural changes. Now, it's similar to developing, when cells develop and differentiate to create the various tissues and organs of the body. So as we know from AMP1, We do have undifferentiated cells, right, that do differentiate into specialization to become the various tissues of the body. They don't start that way, but they become that. The same thing happens in malignancies or in tumors or in cancer. Cells differentiate, but they don't differentiate into something that's functionally normal. So we say that in malignant cells, differentiation is altered and may be lost completely. So I always remember, I had a student, we went to the cadaver lab at the chiropractic college. This is a number of years ago. And when you go into the chiropractic lab, there's 14 or so specimens. So you have these cadavers that have been dissected for all intents and purposes, and so therefore they're fairly accessible internally. And I had a student come up to me, and she said, "I've got this individual over here, and they can't find their stomach." I'm like, "What? I can't find their intestines." And I'm like, "Well, thinking that's pretty impossible. So let's go over and have a look." So we went over and had a look, and where we would have found the stomach and the large and the small colon was one giant cancerous tumor. Okay? The diaphragm had risen 3 to 4 rib levels to the point where the bases of the lungs were crumpled. So I can't imagine the kind of ending that individual had, because no longer was there a stomach or intestine, so the individual's ability to be able to take food in and take nourishment from the food was pretty much lost. It was just one big solid mass, no longer intestines or stomach. All the cells are differentiated into just this tumor. A tumor that has lost identity with the parent tissue is considered to be undifferentiated. In other words, it's called anaplastic. Dysplasia is another term that indicates a disorganization of cells in which the mature cell varies in normal shape, size, or organization. Females, for example, may come across dysplasia quite often when they have a Pap smear. So they when the medical practitioner takes a swab in the area of the cervix, and then those cells that are collected through the technique are placed under a microscope to see if they're normal cervical cells, if they have differentiated, or if there is a disorganization. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean dysplasia does not mean cancer. It can, but it doesn't. So we say usually caused by chronic irritation, uterine epithelium as a result of long-standing irritation. Dysplasia may reverse itself or may progress to cancer. So that's one of the key things, is that when they see dysplasia, say in a Pap smear, then the investigation goes a little bit deeper to see which way things are going. And if a female has found to have dysplasia during a Pap smear, then rather than the normal length of time to the next one, the time gets shortened to make sure that the dysplasia isn't occurring and heading in a direction where it may become malignant. Metaplasia is the first level of dysplasia. It is reversible and benign, but still an abnormal change. An example of that is something called Barrett's esophagus. Has anybody here heard of Barrett's esophagus? It can be associated with a condition called a hiatus hernia. Does anybody know what a hiatus hernia is? Does anybody here have a hiatus hernia? Yeah, you're all too young. Anybody here have a mother or father or grandparent who has a hiatus hernia? With what? Not necessarily. I got mine really young. I actually was taking erythromycin and got into a vomiting thing because I'm sensitive to it, and I started vomiting blood, and I actually tore the sphincter. So if we remember correctly, that the esophagus passes through the diaphragm to get to the stomach, and passing through the diaphragm contributes some muscle fibers, which is a sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach, so that when we eat a meal, the food will not come back up into the esophagus, and neither will all the gastric juices, right? So in some cases, for whatever reason, that sphincter weakens, or if something happens to it, damage, and the individual then, something like a big meal or a relatively large liquid meal, there's the opportunity this material will come back up into the esophagus. So The prime example is after a big meal, if they go and lie down on the couch or bed, they may burp and there's actually food in their burp. I remember that very distinctly. Right? Big Christmas dinner and you got a burp and have food in it. Well, it is, but the diaphragm's there. The diaphragm actually provides the fibers for the sphincter. Okay? So what happens? You get a hole. So the test is, so I had to stand in a machine, a radio machine. I had to drink barium. Okay, I actually like barium, believe it or not. You drink barium, so it's a radioactive kind of chalk, and then they take a picture of your chest wall and they start tilting you back into what's Trendelenburg. So you start with your head down, then you go flat, and then they tilt you with your feet up, and they want to see what happens to the barium. If you have a hiatus hernia, the barium's going to end up in the back of the throat because there's no sphincter to prevent the barium that's in the stomach from moving. So off I go, I take it, and I'm standing there. They take me to supine, they bring me back up again. I'm like, what about the reverse Trendelenburg? They're like, oh no, it was already to the back of your throat. So I had a gastroscopy done, and where your esophageal sphincter should be relatively tight, mine was about that big around. I didn't have one anymore. So any time that I ate big meals or drank too many beer or something, I'd get indigestion. Anyways, the reason I'm going through all that is just because this metaplasia is a Barrett's esophagus. So under the fact that there's no sphincter, the materials and the gastric juices in the stomach start to bubble up and irritate the distal esophagus. So what's the distal esophagus do? It changes the epithelial lining to be more like the stomach. So it goes from squamous epithelium to glandular epithelium, which is, in other words, the distal esophagus is becoming more stomach-like. The chances of Barrett's esophagus becoming cancerous are there. They're not super high, but it does increase the probability of esophageal cancer if you have a Barrett's esophagus. But all it is the body's reaction to a different environment and the cellular changes of the epithelium, but the distal esophagus actually change. Tumors, also known as neoplasms, are defined as abnormal new growth of tissue that serves no useful purpose and can harm the host by competing for vital blood supply and nutrients, defeating its old metabolism. And that is something to kind of almost highlight. Because when we think about cancer, that's kind of cancer in a nutshell. And why cancer really affects us and our physiology is because there becomes a competition between the cancer and normal physiological processes. So first off is this mass that's growing, so it serves no purpose to the body. So if it's in the stomach, it doesn't offer anything extra for the stomach. It's not stomach-like. If it's in the lungs, it's not the same kind of tissue as the lungs. And then the tumor also has its own metabolism, so therefore its own metabolic needs. So it starts to force blood to grow into the tumor itself. So now all of a sudden the tumor is competing with the body for blood supply. And within that blood, the tumor now is also competing for metabolites because it needs what normal cells need in order to stay alive, exist, and grow. One of the big differences we're going to find is the cellular growth in tumors is unbelievably faster than normal cellular growth in your own body under normal circumstances. So cells do die, they are replaced, we have division and so forth. Tumors, for a couple of reasons, the cells just bang, 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 and they just start dividing, and there's no really good control of cellular division. The tumor just keeps growing, and in doing so, it requires more nutrients, it requires more blood at the expense of the host that the cancer's in. And unfortunately, if anybody here has got someone in the family who has passed away from, advanced cancer, quite often by the time, at the time of the demise of the individual, they're down to basically a bit of, their skin lying on bone with absolutely no muscle mass left because the tumor has competed and won. It's almost like, a parasite that's on a tree. It takes all the nutrients out of the tree and eventually kills the tree that it's actually attached to, right? And same thing actually happens in most cases with cancer, is that think of it as a parasite that's taking from the body to the point where the host actually is not able to survive because of what the cancer's taking. There are, of course, tumors can be benign and they can be malignant. So there are primary tumors that arise from cells that are normally local to the given structure. So, we can look at the cancer tumor cells in the organ or the area where the tumor is and recognize it's primary, meaning that it's arising out of the cells that belong in that area. Secondary tumors are tumors that arise from cells that have metastasized from another part of the body. So we can look at certain cells in a tumor and go, oh, those are similar to blah, blah, blah. And so obviously they didn't come from here. They go back and looking at the primary and realize that that's where they've originated from. Did you have a question? Yes. Right. So this is where sometimes, for example, you might see, something along the line of a tumor that's causing lactation, even though you might not see, you might have gone initially to a tumor because the patient has actually gone and complained about, why am I lactating all of a sudden, or I'm a male and I'm lactating even, and they find a tumor somewhere and it's starting to show, it's acting like the pituitary or something along that line, and it's creating chemicals that are forcing the body to perform certain things as though the pituitary were actually doing it. Right, exactly, right. Yeah. They're abnormal. Whether they're secondary or primary, they're always abnormal. But there are ways of saying, okay, this arose from this tissue based upon comparison of normal to the tumor cells. And then if they see a secondary tumor, they go, well, that's not really that cell, but it's a tumor growing in that tissue. Those cells kind of belong over here, so that's likely where it came from. So cancers that are most likely to metastasize, breast cancer, prostate, lung, kidney, thyroid, colon, pancreatic, bone, and liver. Now, in interest's sake, if we go down the line, breast cancer, the general rule is by the time you feel a mass in the breast, it's already considerably advanced, right? Right? If it's palpable, then it's probably well along the way. When it's in its early stages, in most cases, we don't tend to be able to palpate it, right? Prostate cancer, this is one of my big arguments. I still pay for my PSA. I don't care what anybody says. I know they say you don't need it. It creates too many false positives, but I'd rather have a false positive than find out the hard way. So I have my PSAs done every year at my age. I don't really care because of that. I had a friend here, worked here, and he woke up one morning and his leg was like four times the size of the other one with edema, just completely filled up with edema. And the prostate cancer had grown so large that it actually blocked off the inguinal trunk. So the lymph wasn't able to get back up, so his leg swelled up. Lung cancer, well, I mean, as you all probably know, lung cancer, definitely by the time they find it, it's too late because the lungs have so much extra to work with that they don't tend to show signs of problems. Thyroid, it does, but usually thyroid, we don't tend to die from thyroid cancers. We're able to deal with them. And if you think of colon, we now everybody gets their colonoscopies at certain ages. If there's familial history of colon cancers, then you get colonoscopies a little bit more often. I don't know, has anybody here had a colonoscopy yet? No? Well, you could if it was in your family. So if you had like a parent and an uncle or something like that, it's conceivable. Yeah, how old is the average here? Nobody's here in their 40s for sure, right? Oh yeah, Libby's not here. What's that? 25. All I can tell you is this. I don't care if you hear things or not. Colonoscopies are a piece of cake. Okay? Don't ever worry about a colonoscopy. They give you a lovely little drug called propofol, and you have the greatest dreams and sleep you could possibly imagine. Oh, it's the prep. Oh, the prep's not fun. Oh, yeah, you get you. Yeah, okay, there's a period of time where you can't eat, you get a bit grumpy because you're hungry and you poop a lot. I mean, They give you drugs to completely clean you out. But as far as, people get very afraid of, nobody's sticking a camera up there in my body, right? You don't notice it. You're sound asleep, you're having a good dream, you wake up and it's all over. It's a piece of cake. And 3 years ago, I had one, 2 years ago, I had one done. They found two tags in there and there was dysplasia. So if I hadn't got it done, the potential for that becoming a polyp and then becoming cancer was very high because, my great aunt died and my dad's a polyp, so my brother. So don't let anybody tell you it's a terrible thing. It's not that bad. You just go to bed and sleep. Just put them to bed. The prep's way better than it used to be, I'll tell you that.
You sound like you're trying to sell
It is because I, because you got to imagine, I play golf with all the guys my age, right? So we all sit around. This is common talk, except for the guys who go, nobody's sticking a camera up there. I'd rather get a free hip or something or whatever. Yeah, get you, Doug. Did you have a question? I don't know her name. Do you have a question? You had your hand up, so.
Yeah.
How long ago was that? Yeah, we don't do that anymore. So my dad used to get them, and he had to drink this big gallon thing was called Citramax, and literally, I'm sure he woke up the neighbors next door every time he had to sit on the toilet because it just goes. Woof. No, now it's oh, that stuff. He only drink a glass like that. No, it's actually really, really, really sweet. And it's really weird. It tells you when it tells you how much water to use, and you have a little packet, and you put the packet in, you mix it up, and you have to wait because the chemical reaction of the powder to the water goes really hot. And you have to let it cool down, and then you can drink it. Yeah, the reaction between the water and the chemical actually makes the drink very hot. Where you're not supposed to sip it, you're actually supposed to jug it. And it's like, that scene from Stand By Me, the movie with the kid eating the blueberry pie, and he's taking all the laxative, and he's standing there and you hear, brrr, right? Well, you drink this stuff, and about 30 seconds later, you're like, whoa, whoa, because it starts to do its thing, right? Okay. Now, carcinoma in situ, of course, as I said, is a localized, pre-invasive, and possibly pre-malignant tumor of epithelial tissue. They are contained within the host organ, and they have not broken through the basement membrane. And that's one of the things that's important, is that basement membrane actually works very well from preventing metastases. And we're going to learn that some cancers actually produce enzymes to break down the basement membrane to get into the lymph system. They deliberately try to break it down. In situ tumors commonly occur in the cervix, bladder, skin, oral cavity, esophagus, bronchus, and breast. So they generally tend to hang around with. This is why we can kind of get at them fairly early and not have to worry about metastases. Carcinoma in situ that affects glandular epithelium occurs most commonly in the cervix, breast, stomach, endometrium, large bowel, and prostate. The thing to remember is, think of every kind of tissue we have in the body and every organ that we have in the body, and at any point, cells can mutate and turn in the direction of a malignancy. So let's talk about neoplasms first, because that's sort of the term really is new growth. So when we think of neoplasm, we look at an organ, we expect to see it a particular way, and we see this suddenly this lump or bump on it that's new growth that's comparative to the organ we might be looking at. Neoplasms are based on the cell type, so what kind of cell type is growing. The tissue of origin, so is it arising from epithelial tissue, right, versus any of the other tissues, connective tissue, and so forth. Degree of differentiation, so how far has it swung away of what it normally used to be, right? Has it really changed enough or slightly? The anatomic site that should be, or whether it is benign or malignant. Benign growths are usually considered harmless, generally do not spread to or invade other tissues. Benign growths are clinically known as tumors and are not neoplastic. Okay? So if we hear the word tumor, it's likely a benign tumor. They usually represent an overgrowth of normal tissue elements. So they represent as skin tags. So some people get skin tags even on their skin outside the body, polyps of the colon, And polyps of the colon are quite fascinating. They actually look like mushrooms that are growing off the epithelial lining of the colon itself. They have a stalk and a head, and they can be different shapes and sizes coming off the stalk. They just grow, and they don't tend to amount to much. Now, the tumors can become large enough, though, to distend tissues and cause discomfort. Can also cause compression, so they can grow enough that they're compressing on nerve tissue or connective tissue, which results in, again, discomfort or pain that brings the patient to the physician because they've got some pain or discomfort, or obstruct normal tissues and impair normal functions. So again, they can occlude certain things, so grow into the esophagus or grow into against the colon, and again, you'll tend to have symptomology, which will bring it to the doctor because something's not functioning appropriately. Thing to remember about benign tumors, if not taken care of, they can cause disability and possibly death. They can get that large. I have a cousin who had an ovarian cyst or tumor, benign tumor, taken out of her stomach that was 14 pounds. Yes. And for years, she thought she was just obese with the large stomach. She thought she was just obese. You know who found it? It's the weirdest thing. A dentist. Weird, eh? I have no idea. It was the dentist that said to her, I think there's something going on here. You need to go to the doctor. You have? I don't know how they discovered it. I really don't. I don't know. Maybe the way it reacted when she sat down, maybe adipose tissue would just kind of sit there, but maybe the tumor shifted and it looked like something was moving under the skin, under observation. I don't know. Yeah, 14 pounds. Benign or malignant tumors are classified by cell type and are named according to the tissue from which they arise. Epithelial, connective, and muscle, nerve, lymphoid, and hematopoietic tissues. So tissues that produce red blood cells, which would likely be, what kind of tissue are we talking about here? Bone marrow, correct. Right. There is a miscellaneous group, which includes reproductive glands, placenta, and thymus as well. Now, those malignancies that originate in lymphoid tissue are called lymphomas, as compared to the others. And these can arise anywhere where lymphoid tissue is found. Tell me where there isn't lymphoid tissue. Like, it's everywhere, right? So that's why lymphoid cancers are very serious in nature because, you know, we tend to have lymph everywhere in the body. Most common are lymph nodes in the spleen itself. Hematopoietic malignancies include your leukemias, multiple myelomas, myeloid dysplasia, and myeloproliferative syndromes. Eponyms are used to describe the tumors as benign or malignant. So therefore, a lesion of adipose tissue, if it's benign, we call it a lipoma, oma meaning tumor, right? And malignant, it would be a liposarcoma. So it's within the terminology of what you're seeing. If you see a report from a patient, that's where you have to think of the eponym. What is it? Is it an oma or is it a sarcoma? Because that's going to give you a sense of the fact, is this cancerous or is this benign? Because they may not be sure. The patient may not be sure. When we look at structure that we think is cancerous and we decide that it is, we then have to stage and grade it. And within the context of staging and grading, you know, that's sort of in terms of prognoses for the patient, in other words, how chancy it is or it is not for them to survive the cancer and lead a normal life or get rid of the cancer really does affect this. So if it's a stage one, it's what's called a carcinoma in situ, which means it's pre-malignant and pre-invasive, and it's just hanging around where it's starting. It's nowhere else in the body. Stage one is called early stage cancer, again, usually localized to the organ that it is found in. Stage two, there is an increased risk of regional spread because of tumor size or grade. Stage three, there is some spread, but it's regional and may not be disseminated to distant regions. So they sort of note it's, say, if we use breast cancer, for example, there might be some involvement in axillary lymph nodes, but in the region, and there's nothing anywhere else. And stage four, we start to see cancer show up at distant sites from the area where the tumor is. Risk factors. If anybody brought their book with them, please turn to page 355. There is a box there. Advancing age is one of the most significant risk factors for cancer. Why? Why? Why am I at 64? Why am I at greater risk for cancer than the rest of you? That is one possibility. That's correct. Yep. Yes. And what affects that? Do you remember? Do you know? We're going to talk about it a bit. You got it. Yes. All right. So our DNA actually gets smaller and smaller for every time that we get cellular division and on and on. And so the cookbook, which I talked about in semester one, the pages get less and less. The book gets smaller. So because it gets smaller, there's an increased chance of a mutated cell arising out of cellular division. And exactly right. I mean, I think at my age, think of the differences from you folks in terms of the way I was raised is crazy, crazy. You know, things that we didn't think anything of, I ate or slept in or rolled around in or whatever. Everybody here is sort of red dye, 14, 13, right? So that would have been M&M's I ate when I was a kid, right? Weed killer. You know, my dad, I can remember in the fall and in the spring especially, all the neighbors would be doing their lawns, and all you could smell was weed killer. The whole street would just reek of weed killer, right? Because everybody's just spraying the hell out of their lawns, and dogs are running and rolling in it, and all sorts of things. We had like stain, you know, Scotch Guard. My mom would Scotch Guard everything. Like it was very surrounded because it was thought that it was perfectly okay in my generation. You know, TV dinners, Swanson TV dinners. You guys don't know anything about those. It would be an interesting piece of research, yes, to see if there's been an over influence on speeding that process up, per se. Or is it that now we've discovered that the role that telomeres do in terms of recognizing that there's damage and shortening, well, is that normal or is that not normal? And because of what I lived in my time, right? Right? Oh, we thought it was a treat to have fried bologna for dinner. Canned potatoes, Swanson TV dinners. What's that? I didn't like Spam. I never did like Spam. I wasn't a Spam fan. Although I don't know if either of you are Korean. Spam is a very, very big deal in Korea. I can't remember the name of the dish. It's an egg dish that was sort of a fusion of Korean cooking and with the American soldiers. At the time and during the war, and they use Spam quite a bit. It's considered a dish that's eaten quite often in Korea. So the following nine risk factors are responsible for more than one third of cancer deaths worldwide: tobacco, alcohol, obesity, inactivity, diet and nutrition, unsafe sex, urban air pollution, indoor smoke from household fuels, and contaminated injections in healthcare settings. Except for the very last one. Can we change all those in our life? Yep, we sure can. A lot of those are lifestyle things, right? You know, it's something to really think about, that the things that we do in our day-to-day life can have a real detrimental effect on our chances of getting cancer. Smoking, obesity, and alcohol consumption account for nearly one-third of all cancer cases and almost 40% of cancer deaths in the U.S. Smoking, obesity, and alcohol. It behooves me to see anybody smoke nowadays. Does anybody here smoke? You wouldn't tell me no anyways, would you? I used to too. I used to smoke two packs a day.
It's a cultural thing too. Like in Ireland,
Europe is huge. Asian culture is huge in smoking. Yeah, but I see young people all the time. It's like, wow, people still smoke with everything that we know, right? Or vaping. I think we talked about this before. I think vaping is going to, a lot of studies are going to come out of vaping of really bad lung disease, I think. I think there's that part, and the other part is I have, sat in a car in front of, car in front of me where someone's vaping, and if they have a cigarette, the amount of smoke that comes out, say they got their window open and sitting in the car with a cigarette, a little bit of smoke comes out when they exhale and off the cigarette. But when they vape, it's like this, whoosh, this thing comes out of the car, and that's all been in your lungs, and what particulates are in that, and chemicals, and I just don't think it's good. And I told you guys before, I think cannabis smoking, we're going to see a big influence on lung disease from cannabis smoking. Like I said, and I said this is semester ones, and they all chuckled. Like, teachers never told me this before. Have edibles, they're safer. If I go either side of the goalposts, we know that smoking causes cancer. We also know that firefighters for forest fires, and some with housing, right? They have cancer, they have lung cancers as well. Anything that burns is a carcinogenic. You make chemical changes in the smoke because of the heat and the chemical reactions. Any smoke is detrimental to our health. Even cooked food. Well, even this, right? Indoor smoke from household fuels. Now, that tends to boat a little more into third world nations as compared to us, because most of us don't, we don't, use naphtha or those sorts of things in our house. But other cultures, sub-Saharan Africa, that kind of stuff, they do use some fuels in the house to cook their foods, right? So you have the exhaust of that it's also involved with it. But yeah, I'm sure smoking cannabis eventually, because now people who are doing it more regularly are likely to spend more time at it, and you're going to see lung diseases from it. I'm sure we've already seen it, but we don't really associate it yet because it was illegal, so we didn't really do studies on it as well. But I think it will eventually come out that smoking cannabis is really detrimental. Right. That's good. Yeah. Now they can. The only thing is, though, when you smoke a cigarette and you see how much tar and nicotine is in the filter, smoke a joint of really high-end cannabis, and what goop is at the end of that? Like, it's thick, right? There's so much. I think you're going to find there's so much more particulate in cannabis as compared to tobacco. Yeah. But do you still smoke, Shaq? No, but I thought they was crystallized and they just bash it up. And then I thought you put that in and you smoked it. So they drink it? Oh, you do smoke. Oh, you do, oh. Oh, okay. So they've taken oil and done something with it?
They press it basically into oil.
Oh. Okay.
I really like oil.
Oil's my favorite. Oh, okay. Oh, trust me. Right now, I think it's on Prime, is a movie called Dazed and Confused. If you want to know my life as a teenager, you watch that movie. That's my that that's that takes place in the 70s. That was my life. Bush parties, like, yeah, that was my life as a kid. Now, heredity does, to some degree, have an influence. So cancer is a disease of genes. So if it's a disease of genes, it could be that hereditary factors could could influence mutation of genes in your offspring. Only 5 to 10% are actually linked to an inherited gene, and more common are the external factors. So 10% is still enough. So 10% of cancers can be seen as being a hereditary influence, but the majority are smoking, drinking, obesity, and so forth. It's our lifestyle choices. Now, one thing it's interesting, it's not in here, and it's, therefore it's not number one with a bullet or high up on the list, is, you know, your environment in terms of chemicals, whether that be in clothing or in food, in your environment, in the air, pollution, and so forth, right? Aging, older than 50 or 40, depending on what it is, between 2005 and 2009, for all races and gender, time of primary diagnosis was 66 years of age. So I got 2 more years to go to get by the other side. So it is a risk factor, your age, to a higher risk of cellular mutation, which results in cancer. The fact that as we age, there is an increase in the likelihood of comorbidities, influences the limitations of life expectancy, and the increase of treatment complications. So that's the other thing that happens. So you have cancer, and you're young, well, they can do a lot for you, and possibly the outcome is quite good. But as we get older, and we have comorbidities, then the treatments that we may use to help individuals get through cancer won't work as well because there's too many side effects to it. And in some cases, of course, as we get to 66, you know, that then above, you know, people have got heart disease, hypertension, they're taking medications for it and so forth. And you get all these possible interactions. Longer exposure to carcinogens, as was suggested here with age, decrease in immune function with age, accumulate non-lethal damage to DNA. So therefore, everything gets more a risk factor. Yeah. No, it's small, but there is some influence in 5 to 10% of the cancers. Tobacco is a carcinogen. I should underline that and bold it. It's a carcinogen. Think about it though, from a common sense point of view, right? Take this smoke and suck it in. Who came up with that? Right? Now, in my smoking days, I used to love European tobacco, Turkish tobacco. I don't know if anybody has ever seen it or smoked it. That the stuff that when you, it like a cigarette I used to smoke was called Jetem. It was from Paris, it was from France. And I would have a cigarette across the table from you. And by the time I was halfway through, we couldn't see each other for the blue smoke that was so thick coming off the cigarette. But I love that really deep, rich smoke in my lungs.
The worst part of cigarettes.
Yeah, so when I used to work up, there's lots. So when I used to work up in BC, up in the interior when I was 19 years old, I did a trip out west and I ended up working for an oil company. We were walking through the Rockies for like 6-8 months doing work looking for oil. When we were up there, the rule was you were not allowed to bring in cigarettes, normal cigarettes, because normal cigarettes burn. So when you're done with it and you throw it in the bush, they continue to burn, cause a forest fire. We used to smoke roll your owns.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the tobacco. It was the only one we were allowed to use. Because if you didn't smoke it, it went out. And you'd have to light it back up again.
But it's interesting because I'm wondering that tobacco itself is carcinogen, or are we talking about cigarettes? Tobacco is just like a...
Tobacco is a carcinogen. When you burn tobacco and the byproduct chemicals, and it has to do with the extreme heat at the heater, at the end where you're smoking, the heat is so significant, it converts chemicals into other chemicals which are really bad for you. I would say look that up. I don't know. Yes?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, big time. Oh, bad epithelial tumors and lung cancer. My great aunt died of tongue cancer. It was terrible. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, have you ever tried it? Anybody here ever tried chewing tobacco? Tried it once. Once. The first 4 chews were like, hey, this is pretty good. And then all of a sudden.
Have you ever watched the
Sandlot? Yes.
When they do chew and then they all throw up on their eyes.
Oh. Yeah, I don't understand. Again, I don't understand how people do it. And then there's the snuff where that's like mint flavored and pineapple flavored and tobacco continues to cause 90% of lung cancers. Smoking also increases the risk of cancer of the urinary bladder, so there actually is a direct correlation to urinary bladder cancer and smoking, pancreas, and to a lesser extent, kidney, larynx, oral cavity, and esophagus. Yes? I think one of the influencing factors is how often it's used. So in indigenous cultures where they may be smoking tobacco in certain ceremonies and so forth and not smoking it regularly, I don't know I would have as much of an effect as here in North America. You got a pack of cigarettes, you start with 2 a day, 4 a day, 10 a day, 12 a day, pack a day, and so forth. Then it just starts to add up and cause problems. Diet and nutrition, 1/3 of cancer mortality in developing countries may result from dietary causes. The thoughts are that poor diet blunts the immune response, and if we have genetic damage, if a cell is mutated, there is an immune response, and the mutated cell, under normal circumstances, is destroyed, and therefore you don't get an overgrowth of these mutated cells. Diet and nutrition can influence carcinogenesis positively or negatively by providing bioactive compounds to specific tissues or by modulating hormone levels. So diet can have an effect in a good way to prevent a cancer and can have a bad effect by causing cancer depending on what your choices are in your food that you eat. Okay. Consider the role of fiber in the diet and its relationship to colon cancer, right? The idea is that, you know, in cultures where small amounts of fiber are eaten within the grains that are eaten, then the increase of cancer occurs. Did you know that back historically, white bread was for the rich and high grain breads were for the poor? So like during the Egyptians and the Romans and so forth, the more refined the flour was, the more it was going towards the more royal folks, and the basic brown, black breads of unrefined grains were for the slaves. Yeah, no kidding, right? And the taste, too. Come on. Alcohol consumption has been linked to increased rates of cancer of the mouth, pharynx, larynx, esophagus, liver, breast, and probably colon. Interesting here, though, alcohol consumption can increase the circulating levels of estrogens, possibly increasing the risk for breast cancer and or reoccurrence of breast cancer. And alcohol consumption, along with tobacco, increases the risk of malignant tumors because the alcohol acts as a solvent for the carcinogenic smoke products. It actually promotes the carcinogenic products of tobacco to go into the body easier. Yeah. It acts as a solvent and actually allows those carcinogenics to get in the body easier. Sober you up?
Yeah.
Interesting. I only know it's when I smoked. If I smoked and drank, where I might normally smoke like 10 cigarettes, I'll come out of a bar on a Saturday night and probably smoke 2 packs. Because for whatever reason, it was back in the day. Sexual reproductive behaviors. The risk of developing cervical cancer is linked with early sexual intercourse and multiple partners. Pregnancy and childbearing seems to protect against cancers of the endometrium, ovary, and breast. Now, certain sexually transmitted diseases... What?
I was like, God, maybe not.
Oh.
And then also, who is a gen that was saying that like sexual transmitted diseases are linked to birth control protects against cancer because it...
So, everybody knows about HPV, right? We'll get there. We're going to talk about it. Statistically, I'm not pointing fingers at any individual. If we look at the statistics, so there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. There's 16 people in this room. Statistically, under what they say about HPV, of the 16 of you, mathematically, how many of you would have HPV? Let's forget about the vaccine. Because most of you probably didn't have it, right? Oh, wow. Right. Yeah. Nine of you would have HPV. Yeah. Is it now? Oh, cool. Yeah, because it got to the point where it was 50 to 60%. Yeah, yeah. So females generally never know they have it. Males can, because males can grow warts on their genitals. So they're aware that they likely have HPV, or females, because it tends to aggregate around the mouth of the cervix, will not know that they have it until they go in for an internal with a physician, who then says, looks like you've got HPV and we need to, you know, burn some tissue and get rid of, there's warts growing on the cervix. Or has had it.
Yes.
Has had it, right. It's very significant sexually transmitted disease. Between 50 and 65%, some say 75%, yeah? Yeah, yeah, it's quite high. It's one of those things that it saddens me because it's all about culture, right? We don't want to talk about it, North American culture, because my daughter doesn't have sex. She's 25, but she's still a virgin, isn't she? Right? There's that whole problem with, you know, remember when the vaccine first came out, the uproar of parents, because by giving the vaccine, we were promoting sexual activity. Come on. Like, it drives me crazy. Anyways, 70% of HPV-related cervical cancer is caused by either one of these two. Only HPV-16 or HPV-18. So it depends on, because there are a number of, because human papillomavirus, which is what HPV stands for, can also be in other areas of the body rather than the genitals, correct? Which is where? Anus, skin, lips, right? It makes warts. Where do you grow warts? Could be anywhere, right? So it really depends. Right? So, but 16 or 18 are kind of directly responsible for cervical cancer. Most genital HPV infections will not cause cancer. Smoking can also raise the risk of cervical cancer in women with HPV. It just gets better and better, doesn't it, girls? Yep. Hormonal exposure is a factor for women. A prolonged exposure to estrogen is a risk factor for estrogen-sensitive breast cancer. I'm going to jump all the way down, because here's something that's very interesting. Women's Health Initiative resulted in the halt of the use of estrogen-progesterone combination in 2002 and in the halt of estrogen use in 2004, because the numbers have started showing up of the increase in breast cancer when women were being treated for postmenopausal symptoms with hormone therapy started going through the roof, right? Yeah, it was quite amazing. So we say here, prolonged use of estrogen hormone replacement therapy for postmenopause symptoms has been linked with increased rates of breast cancer. Individuals who used these hormones therapeutically were found to have increased rates of breast cancer, heart disease, stroke, and blood clots. And it makes sense, right? Because what's one of the side effects of oral contraception? No. I don't really regularly buy oral contraceptives. Yes. Wow. But the question becomes, it's like when you watch drug ads on TV, especially in the U.S., right? You know, they tout this drug is going to change your life and make you feel better in like $1 million, but could cause your penis to drop off, your heart to explode, strokes, go blind. Who does? Or does he? Yeah. Exactly, right at the end of the day. So, yes. Well, not necessarily, because you have to understand that when we look at from a, okay, this is where it gets really complicated because gender is now fluid, right? So, but if we go to the traditional sense, high estrogen, generally female, high testosterone, generally male, for all intents and purposes, in the olden days, shall we call it, right? So if we have someone over here who has a high amount of testosterone, who has decided that their gender is incorrect and they wish to alter their gender to go the other way, which is a higher level of estrogen, they then apply estrogen to change the influence of the testosterone so that breast tissue may grow, you know, hair less likely to grow in facial voice changes and so forth. So I don't think there's been anything yet that would suggest that we're increasing the risk of cancers for those individuals. I wouldn't be surprised if there's being some research done, but it's not like we're overloading. So when a female is postmenopausal, those big swings of estrogen and progesterone have come down to here, and we're trying to get them back to here again. So I don't know if the idea of a gender reassignment sort of thing is, you know, is there suppression of testosterone and increase of estrogen, or is there just an increase of estrogen? I'm not really sure. Does anybody know? Like, has anybody got a friend who? Well, I can tell you this. I do have a direct story to your question. So when I worked at the hospital in cardio, this is probably in about 2004, 2003, we had a gentleman who came in who had a heart attack, and he was about 22 years old. Pretty rare to see a 22-year-old male come in with an MI, right? A significant MI. So he came in, and in those days, it was during the blood clot, the blood thinning medications, ATPAs is what we used. So the idea was, if there's a blood clot in the heart and it's causing an occlusion, if we give you a blood thinning medication, it'll dissolve the clot and the heart damage won't be as bad. So it was all part of that. As part of that regime, I had to go and do an ECG every 25 to 30 minutes because it can cause arrhythmias and all sorts of things. So I got in and saw this individual a number of times. And then finally, you know, I was done in the emerge room, and of course they went up to the ICU because they had an MI. And so I went up, and I heard the nurses talking about how this individual refused to take their underwear off because, being in the ICU, they needed to catheter the patient, right, which is normal for ICUs to be cathetered with an MI. They don't want you up walking around. Well, they discovered, because they finally talked the individual into removing their underwear, that there was female genitalia. So it was someone who was transitioning. And the reason for the heart attack was because they were taking mass amounts of testosterone to reassign their gender to male.
If I'm not mistaken, they do block and wait for it to decrease over a few weeks and then get.
And then on top, okay. Yeah. So the internal medicine specialist told me that the heart attack was due to the increased use of testosterone to reassign the gender. So why wouldn't it, if you're taking large amounts of estrogen, right? It could possibly be. It was actually very sad. I was very disappointed and disturbed by what I heard in the hospital for this individual. I remember distinctly a male specialist, internal specialist, saying, "What do I call it?" I know. His name was Jess, and his female had been Jesse, and I used to talk to him all the time. I don't have any problem with, you know, it's your life if you live the life you need. But yeah, the hospital didn't know how to deal with it, which is really quite unfortunate. But if you read any of the research on transitioning peoples, they have terrible time with healthcare, right? They don't get good healthcare because people's own personal opinions get in the way of whatever the individual is attempting to do for themselves. Yes.
Sorry, because some of these are under the risk factors.
Yep.
Are you including the hormonal exposure and sexual
hormones? Yep. Yep, I am. They may not be in the top nine, but they're still risk factors. Testosterone can increase the risk of prostate cancer in men. And this is something that's really interesting because men, you know, you're hearing all these new advertisements for the past 5 years, right? ED. That's a new generated disease. Everybody knows what ED is, right? It's erectile dysfunction. Okay. Why do most men have erectile dysfunction? Do you know? No. It's called a beta blocker. Most of them have either heart attack or hypertension, so they have to take beta blockers, and beta blockers doesn't work anymore, right? Because beta blockers block the beta signals for the sympathetic nervous system. Remember, the erection or the loading of the gun is parasympathetic, and the firing of the gun is sympathetic. So that's the whole process of having an erection and then an orgasm. So that's the two systems. So beta blockers screw that all up. So that's the whole reason almost why got the little blue pill more than anything else as far as that goes. But the thing is, you also get a decrease in testosterone. So you've probably heard, or maybe you have grandfathers or uncles or whatever, and they got the patch on because they're starting to get breast involvement because as testosterone comes down, estrogen's starting to influence a little bit more. So you'll see a little bit more fat on the body. You might see gynecomastia where the breast tissue is starting to come more female-like, so they're actually look like they're actually getting breasts because the testosterone is dropping. So again, they attempted to do estrogen therapy like they did in females post-menopause. Well, they've discovered that prostate cancer testosterone pills is like fertilizer. So if you have any kind of pretense to prostate cancer and someone puts you on testosterone, you're well on your way. In fact, my ex-father-in-law had prostate cancer and did a whole treatment, had a prostatectomy and radiation and so forth. They actually, a lot of times, gave him a medication that suppressed testosterone and influenced estrogen. The idea being that he was like stage three or stage four. By lowering testosterone, increasing an estrogen environment, that is less likely that the prostate cancer was going to grow and therefore metastasize and move around. The problem is, it was called Lupron, is the drug that he was on, and the side effect was kidney disease, a kidney damage, and sure enough, he's like got kidney failure and he needs hemodialysis twice a week. So, incidences of cancer, it varies geographically. Those who live in rural areas are less likely to use preventative screening services or exercise regularly. Colon cancer is more prevalent in urban areas, but rurally, especially with farmers, skin cancer is more common because they're less likely to go in and seek help. Geographically, different areas have greater or lesser susceptibility to cancer due to the variability exposure to carcinogens. So that's the other thing. What do you live in? There are increased rates of cancers in southwestern Ontario. In the Hamilton area, right? Lots of air pollution and chemicals. I've read some reports on the Sarnia area because of all the big chemical factories there. There's increases of cancer and birth defects and so forth because of the environment of that area. There's an increase in it because of their environment. Increased incidences of cancers in urban areas can be the result of increased pools of minorities, which equals increased poverty. Possibly increase local smoking ordinances and diet. Occupational or environmental exposure to chemical fibers such as asbestos, radon, and air pollution is a risk factor for lung and hematologic cancers such as leukemia. Environmental or occupational exposure can cause heritable genetic and chromosomal mutations that can be passed to the next generation. This is why, what's it called? That all those little stickers that are on jars and walls and what'd you call it, what was all that stuff? WMIS. That's why WMIS came to be. Because we started to realize that what we thought were minor chemicals, if you're exposed to them enough times, could be extremely detrimental to your health. And this is why you're supposed to know by looking at something how to protect yourself against them if you're around them. How many people here have heard of radon? So it's a radioactive gas that occurs naturally when the uranium in soil and rock breaks down. It's invisible, it's odorless, and it's tasteless. When it's released from the ground, it gets diluted by air and who cares? However, in enclosed spaces like homes, it can accumulate to high levels. So when you inhale it, it decays into radioactive particles that start floating around your body. And therefore, damages lung cells. And then the potential for cancer is high. I grabbed this map just to give you a sense. Red is extremely high, blue is guarded, and green is elevated. So where do we live? What kind of Right down here, right? Right there. We're in red. Where there's Simcoe right there. Yeah, right in the red. I believe you can buy at Home Hardware or Lowe's or whatever, right? You can buy a, you put it on your wall and it'll beep, beep, beep. Can you treat, can you do things to the house to, can you paint it or something or? Yes. Oh. I don't know, because they say the worst is the rec room. If you have if part of your house is down below the ground level, like a rec room, and you have, yeah, it's bad. If you've got radon, it's really bad because it just accumulates in there, and you're just sucking it in. Oh yes, that makes sense. Yeah. Right. Oh yeah. Oh, I get. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense, though. But again, they got stuck in the paradigm that that was going to cure all, and that wasn't what I needed. So always remember that. Use every tool possible to help your patient. Okay, let's continue on cancer. So we talked about risk factors here, radon and so forth. The incidence, as we're talking about, you know, we were saying here that it varies geographically, and of course that can depend, that geographic influence can mean, you know, the kind of environment you live in, the amount of poverty, the particular social behaviors and practices within your geographic region and so forth. The other thing is, other things can influence us, and this might scare a bunch of you. It is suggested that even low-dose exposure to imaging radiation can result in the development of malignancy. You have a 1 in 1,000 chance of developing cancer from a single CT scan of the chest, abdomen, or pelvis. So have I. The latency period of that would be within 2 to 5 years. If it was going to happen, it would take 2 to 5 years to get a leukemia, or possibly 10 to 30 years for an actual solid tumor to form from that one time in having a CT scan. Ethnicity can make a great influence on the incidence of cancer. Racial, so we say racial disparities do exist. So from an African American perspective, incidence of mortality from cancer is approximately 14% higher in African Americans compared with whites. Now, the thing you have to remember here, and the reason why I put American healthcare system in here, remember they don't have a universal system down there, right? And they have basically a two-tiered system. If you have money, you get this system. If you don't, and you're more poverty in the more poverty-stricken areas, you get this type of healthcare. And unfortunately, therefore, then, really influences the incidences and the treatment and so forth. So this is influenced by age, under 65 incidence, then over 65. Equal treatment yields equal outcomes. So this is what they're finding, that it's about access in the U.S. because of their system. It, no matter what your ethnicity is, if you have access, you're going to have the same outcomes no matter what your ethnicity is. But because of the problems in the U.S. with the hierarchy of wealth and so forth, you tend to get these influenced numbers. Incident rates of prostate cancer are more than 50% higher than rates compared to other ethnic groups within the African-American community. Now, part of that could be that within the culture of the African-American male, they don't want to go to see a physician if there is symptomology. Lung cancer is the leading cause of death to both males and females of African-American descent in the U.S., which, in my mind, would suggest they're more likely to smoke. Hispanics and Latinos. Now, what's interesting about Hispanics and Latinos within the American culture or diaspora, 23 different countries represent Latino-Hispanic peoples, which means that the diversity is crazy wide because of the number of different countries. Racial variations exist in tumor growth, susceptibility, and treatment to exposure. Hispanic Latino populations have different drug resistance expressions than non-Hispanic Latino whites. So it's interesting. Within their genetics, some drugs that work on Caucasians, American Caucasians, don't work as well on Hispanic Latino Americans because of their genetic makeup. This group have a lower incidence and death rates than non-Hispanic whites. The thing is, when we look at Hispanic Latinos, the longer they end up in the U.S., the more incidence they have of cancer because of the influence of the environment that they're in if they're living here longer. Asian Americans, these are the only racial ethnic group to experience cancer as the leading cause of death. More cancer of infectious origin, HPV-induced cervical cancer, HBV, which is hepatitis B-induced liver cancer, and stomach cancer than any other minority group. So the Asian Americans suffer more from infectious origin HPVs, hep B, and liver cancer and stomach cancer. Absolutely. So they still, but there's still a risk factor. So because of the opportunities or lack thereof, that then in itself creates risk factors within that ethnic group because of the opportunities, yes or no. So therefore it increases the risk because they don't get the opportunities, whether that's financial or racial or whatever it might be, it still acts as a risk factor that increases the risk in that ethnicity to be in an environment where it's more likely they'll end up with cancer. And again, on top of it, because of the way that their medical system works, it's not universal like ours. So in some cases, they don't have the ability to see someone like we do in Canada. Yes. 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 So if we were to take someone who is a new immigrant, you know, they would meet those standards of less likely cancer. Whereas if they stay in the U.S., the longer they're there, the more they become more American, shall we say, in terms of their incidence of cancer and so forth. If they would just do the research, it would say, okay, when did you come to the U.S.? And then they would look at the cross section of the Hispanic Latinos, and they would say, well, when you're new to the country, here's where your incidence of cancer is. After 5 years, you're here. After 15 years, you're here. After 25 years, you're here in terms of your incidence of cancer. Well, they're closer to the norm. Oh, no, I hate to use that word because that sounds really racist. They're closer to the average. So if we look at certain averages of those who were born and raised in the U.S. and we look at immigration status, the longer you would live in the U.S., the closer you would get to the average. Does that make sense? Because of...
People who are born and raised in America are already higher.
Yeah, to them, in comparison. So to looking at someone who is of white... Because in terms of race, ethnicity, so white, African-American, Hispanic, and so forth, you look at a white's numbers, and then you would look at Hispanics and say initially they're quite low, but the longer they stay in the U.S., the more they get up to the norm, whatever that is. We're not saying that Americans have any more cancer. We're just comparing the different ethnicities to each other and their incidences of cancer. But it's a good point because... like I said, with, you know, the healthcare system and so forth, there are so many things that influence it, right? If you're Asian, are you more likely to smoke? If you're Black, are you more likely to not go to a physician? Like, and that could be for lots of reasons. It could be, again, is there a higher incidence of poverty in the African American population as compared to the white, as compared to the Hispanic? It's a very broad statement that doesn't speak to all the layers that would influence the reason why they say that, because there'd be so many layers to it, so many layers that would influence your probability or lack thereof of actually getting cancer based upon your ethnicity. Does that make sense? Part two. Where are we here? Okay. There. So we have to look at the pathogenesis of cancer. In the beginnings of looking at cancer, it was hypothesized that the cause was genetic changes in a single cell. So that was the initial hypothesis. You know, what causes cancer? Well, the thoughts were it was genetic changes in a normal cell. Evidence has continued to prove that this is exactly what happens. This is known as the somatic mutation theory. So there's mutations in the cell. Tumor cells are characterized by numerical and structural chromosomal abnormalities. So the number of chromosomes and the change in the chromosomal patterns result in abnormalities which can cause cancer. This can include deletion of entire chromosomes. So these deletions may lead to neoplastic changes when a tumor suppression gene is lost. So we are always mutating cells. Good Lord, we are always mutating cells. Every time we have division doesn't mean that every cell we produce is perfect. So we do have these tumor suppression sort of attributes that recognize a mutation and destroy it before it gets anywhere. So deletions can lead to neoplastic changes when a tumor suppression gene is lost. So large bowel cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer, we see the loss of a tumor suppression gene. Translocations. This is when we get exchanges of chromosomal material. So when two or more chromosomes exchange material, which we find in leukemias and sarcomas, then we start to see cancer. And the last is inversions and insertions. So this, again, is changes in the chromosomes. Less common, but still cause abnormal side-by-side placement of genetic material. So what we would see is a normal chromosomal sort of arrangement, somehow it's altered, whether that's through deletion, translocation, or inversions and insertions. So when we looked at cancer, we asked the question, are acquired chromosomal abnormalities the cause of the neoplastic changes in cells, or are they merely the result of the neoplastic state? What does that mean? Yes, chicken or the egg, right? Exactly. Are acquired chromosomal abnormalities the cause of the neoplastic changes in cells, or merely the result of the neoplastic state? So is the cancer causing the chromosomal abnormalities, or are the chromosomal abnormalities causing the cancer? To answer this question, we had lots of research done, and therefore out of this research came two functional different classes of cancer-relevant genes have been detected. The first are genes that are called dominant oncogenes. And the second are called recessive tumor suppressor genes. All of these are present in cells. In a normal non-mutated cell, they have a role where they actually contribute to the division of a cell and cellular death. So they are part of normal cellular physiology. The activation of oncogenes, along with the inactivation of tumor suppressor genes, is an important driver of cancer progression. So oncogenes, meaning genes that can cause cancer, right, result in cancer, and inactivation of these tumor suppressor genes that stop mutations of chromosomes and the lack thereof, these are the big drivers of cancer progression. Okay? Let's talk about oncogenes. They are small segments of genetic DNA, also known as cancer-causing genes. They have the ability to take a normal cell and make it malignant. More than 100 different ones have been found in the cell, but there is a non-mutated form of the oncogene known as the proto-oncogene, and a proto-oncogene is a normal part of a cell. It gets involved in the cell's normal biologic processes, okay? So that proto-oncogene is normal. To have a proto-oncogene become an oncogene, this is where we think that carcinogens that maybe we eat or we breathe in or we're surrounded by change the proto-oncogene or help create the oncogene, which of course is the cancer-causing gene. When we have oncogenes present, the cell grows when it's not required to. So when, you know, there are mechanisms in normal tissue physiology and the cells therein of growth that is regulated. Growth is regulated of when it's time for cells to die, to be replaced, and so forth. So we say oncogenes force the cell to grow when it's not required to, and this can be ceaselessly, and this is done through the release of strong growth-stimulating signals. So within these oncogenes, they're driving the cell to grow uncontrollably, to divide, and continue to become larger and larger and larger. So it's almost like within the cell, it's been hijacked to just grow uncontrollably within what will eventually become a tumor or a change in the organ with cells that really don't belong there. Tumor suppressor genes are known as anti-oncogenes, and they have the opposite effect. So oncogenes are cancer-causing genes, right? Tumor suppressor genes stop the creation of cancer. When activated, they regulate the growth of the cell, and they inhibit carcinogenesis. So if we have some way to inhibit tumor suppressor genes, then oncogenes will take over, and we get cancer. Oncogenes just start driving cells to grow in the wrong direction at the wrong time, and we end up with a tumor or cancer. Everybody understand? Any questions? Chromosomal deletion are chromosomal changes inactivate a tumor suppressor gene through chromosomal deletion. So we want these tumor suppression genes here, obviously, because that's going to prevent cancer from coming. But we end up with chromosomal deletion, which then inactivates the tumor suppressor gene and allows the oncogene to become stimulated. So missing the chromosomal regions were found in carcinomas of the lung, breast, bladder, and kidney. So again, when we look at these cancers, we discover oncogenes and tumor, these tumor suppressor genes are inhibited and shut down, and therefore this is what they're seeing in the chromosomal portions of tumor cells. Now, that's what we were talking about earlier. It's something called cellular age, and this has to do with these telomeres. So as cells divide and grow older, there is a progressive shortening of the end portions of the chromosomes, and these end portions are known as telomeres or telomeres. There's a strong theory that this is why we get old and see all the changes that we see in the human organism as we get older, skin getting thinner, muscle mass getting smaller, so on and so forth. Oh, these guys here? It didn't work?
Well, they gave me, they said it's now.
It's these ones here.
Yeah, but to return the key.
Oh!
She gave me a code in the PT drop box down between 350 and 350.
Do you want me to give it to Lynn tomorrow? I'll put it on my desk?
Yeah, if you can, because I can't get that code.
Okay,
so.
I will. No problem. I'll put it on my desk and I'll give it to her. I'll put it on her desk tonight before I go. Thanks, Dave. Dave is a chiropractor. He used to teach in this program all the time. Dave actually was a teacher at CCMH when I went to CCMH in 95. And was a teacher there, I think, even in the 80s. He's been a chiropractor for a long time. So we've got the telomeres. So the theory is that the shortening of telomeres results in all the changes that we see when a human gets older. There is a close association with the development of cancer and the overproduction of the enzyme telomerase. And the telomerase prevents the shortening of the telomere, which results in a cell living too long. So there is an association with these telomeres and the cell recognizing that it's old and time to die and be replaced by a new cell. If we have a way of not having the chromosome shorten and then keeping sort of the chromosomes sort of active within the cell lives too long, and the longer the cell lives, the more likely it is to mutate, which again increases the possibility of cancer. Telomerase has been found in over 85% of human cancer cells. The cell lives longer, which increases the risk of mutation. So a cell is supposed to die. It's supposed to have a life of its own. And if we suddenly have an enzyme that prevents the shortening of the telomere, the cell ends up living too long and it will mutate. Chronic inflammation, again, is another source of the possibility of cancer. So inflammation in the metabolic products of phagocytosis are quite often accompanied by the excess formation of reactive oxygen, which we know of as free radicals, which of course can cause damage to the chromosomes, which can result in mutations as well. Metastases, which kind of talked about, is the spread of cancer from the primary site to other locations. The cells break away from the primary tumor, travel through the body via blood or lymph, and become trapped in the capillaries of an organ. Once they get trapped in the capillaries of the organ, they infiltrate the tissue of that organ, and then you start to get new tumor growth within the tissue of the organ where the new cells have settled. Cancer can also spread via direct contact with other organs. So, for example, ovarian tumors, they shed the cells into the peritoneal cavity, and then they start to grow where they will then start to cover the surface of the abdominal organs, causing change to occur there as well. So that's considered like a direct type of contact. The patterns of metastases differ from cancer to cancer, so it depends on what kind of cancer you're looking at. Excuse me, sorry. Table 9-3 on page 367 shows those. So you get a sense of where they all travel. Have you got it there? It's pretty extensive. Did you find it?
Yeah,
it is an entire page, right? But it gives you a sense when we compare. Yeah. Now you know why we can look back. When we find a tumor, we can look back and see where it may have come from, right? So if you get a chance, take a look at that box. It's quite shocking. Seed versus soil theory. So metastases only occur if the cancer cell, the seed, finds a favorable microenvironment to grow in the host, the soil. So cancer cells float around, which is risky in itself, but that cancer cell needs to find some place that is suitable for it to grow into. So there's been quite a bit of research done it. What's interesting is that certain tumor cells seem to have an affinity for some organs. So it has to do, I think, with cellular markers and the environment that organ is in, and the cancer cell floats around and says, yeah, I can't really grow over here, but oh, this is good for me. And I embed myself into that tissue or organ, and I can grow in it because it's good for me. It's good soil for me. The host cells seem to secrete growth factors that prompt tumor cell replication. So for some reason, there's an association with the tumor cell and the organ as it goes by, and it promotes cell replication and therefore tumor growth. Another thing that happens within the context of this is called angiogenesis. So of course, any tissue that a tumor cell is going to go into, or any organ it's going to go into, there is a network of vascularity in that tissue for obvious reasons, maintaining, you know, blood and nutrients to the tissue and its metabolic requirements. Well, the tumor can produce chemicals that force those blood vessels to grow at a rate that they grow into the tumor and start to feed the tumor's metabolic requirements rather than the tissues. And this is known as angiogenesis. With rapid growing tumors, millions of tumor cells are shed into the vascular system each day. So you may have an active tumor, you are shedding tumor cells, lots of them. The nice thing is tumor cells don't like turbulence. So imagine, if you will, as the blood is traveling through blood vessels, it's bumping and there's currents in blood. This turbulence, as blood travels through the cardiovascular system, damages the cancer cells and they don't survive, 99% of them. 1% of them can survive, but understand, for metastases to happen, there still has to be a significant amount of coordination between the seed and the soil in order for cancer to take hold and then therefore grow. Suffice to say, mathematically, the more cancer cells in the blood, the higher likelihood of a metastasis occurring somewhere else in the body from the major tumor. These interactions between the cancer host, which results in a metastatic colony, is known as the metastatic cascade. So a number of things happen for this to occur. Once the tumor starts to move locally, so the resultant tumor starts to move locally and blood vessels from pre-existing vessels grow into the solid tumor. And as I said, this is known as tumor angiogenesis. There was something I watched many years ago. They were starting to discover some of the chemicals that stimulated the normal growth of blood vessels to have normal blood vessels grow into the tumor. And they were trying to create drugs that would suppress angiogenesis. So therefore, if a tumor doesn't have blood, that tumor is likely to shrivel and die or not become any larger. I don't know if they work that well, because I'm sure there's still medications out there from a chemotherapy perspective that do reduce angiogenesis. I'm just not sure how successful they are. Of course, because there's blood going to the area, it definitely helps meet the metabolic demands of the tumor. And without that blood, the tumor would remain relatively small and, of course, a much less chance of metastases anywhere else in the body. So we can say that proteins within the tumor promote the growth of the new blood vessels from nearby blood vessels that branches create and end up going into the tumor. Now we have the blood vessels into the tumor. Not only are we feeding the metabolic need of the tumor within the blood, you know, and the nutrients and oxygen and so forth, we also have a higher probability of cancer cells breaking away and traveling through the bloodstream because there's actually blood vessels in the tumor itself. So this increases the probability for cancer cells to enter the bloodstream and create distinct colonies. Something that you may have all heard before, and it turns out to be true, is that resection or surgery without clear margins has the potential to provide remaining tumor cells to metastasize. So we've all heard, right, when they cut you open, the chance of cancers spreading is quite high. You've probably all heard that before. So this is why they really strongly work on removing all the margins of the tumor and any tissue that may be influenced by said tumor, because the resection, so when we cut something open, obviously we're going to get new blood come to the area, we're going to get healing, more blood vessels and so forth. If they don't resect the tumor appropriately and don't remove all that tissue of the tumor or any of the tissue around the tumor, then the chances of metastases increases immensely, because now you have fresh blood supply that allows these cancer cells to travel throughout the body. Tumors also create an enzyme that can dissolve the basement membrane and break through into the lymphatic system. So again, the basement membrane needs to be removed in order for the lymphatics to be infiltrated by these cancer cells. Cancer pain is the last part here. It's the most common symptom of cancer. So 35 to 70% of individuals in the early stages of newly diagnosed cancer and 60 to 90% in the later stages of cancer all will present with pain. This equates with a quarter of adults of newly diagnosed, one-third of those undergoing treatment, and three-quarters with advanced disease all have pain of some kind, okay? So it tends to be some kind of problem, again, whether it's the cancer itself or even some of the interventions that are used to help cure the cancer. Depression and anxiety can increase the perception of the pain. Much pain goes unreported as many patients are reluctant to take pain medication. And it seems to be a cultural thing that, you know, you have this massive tumor growing in your belly and you're in agonizing pain, but I'm not taking pain medications. I'm not taking them. This results in lack of pain control and loss of function due to pain. So it's one of those things. And some of the pain management now, we recognize, I don't know if anybody here is anybody that's had significant surgery and they've been on pain medication. So the new management, so when we take pain medication, generally what happens is the pain's bad, we take pain medication, the pain disappears. And then the pain comes back, take pain medication, the pain disappears. So we get these spikes up and down. If you're in the hospital post-surgical of anything that's a relatively invasive procedure, they manage your pain by doing this. They don't want this because you don't heal as well and you don't function as well. So they'll give you pain management that the pain sort of stays not too bad, but not too little. So the changes are occurring like this, not these big spikes. Yes?
Why is there a different height on 35?
Probably because the cancer in the early stages is not involved in as much tissue. So it's not going to have a greater percentage of neural involvement that we'd express as pain. So if you have a small tumor that's been discovered, it's not until it gets larger and more tissue or organs get involved that the pain recognition starts to go up. Whereas at end stage, you know, when we're at the end of cancer, we have a lot of tissue and organ involvement, so we tend to feel a lot more discomfort and pain because of the changes. Cancer pain is multifaceted. It depends on the tissues involved and as well the mechanism of it. Again, another table to have a look at is on 4371. Great table that shows the different causes of the pain and how, depending on the tissue, what the pain is expressed as by the patient. Some pain is caused by pressure on nerves or the displacement of nerves. So sometimes the cancer isn't the cause of the pain. But because the mass is there, it's either moved a nerve over or it's compressing on a nerve, which then causes the pain that the patient has. It's a result of the cancer, but it's not necessarily the cancer itself that's actually causing the pain. Tumor cells can infiltrate nerves, like because it's still tissue. It's like any other tissue. Cancer can get into a nerve. That usually is expressed as sharp stabbing pain that follows basically a myotome or a dermatome. Okay? Ischemic pain can also occur due to occlusion from mass or a blockage in organs. Common causes of cancer pain are metastases to bone. It is one of the number one causes of cancer pain is bone cancer. So if someone gets metastases to the bone, it's usually very painful. And it's anybody here, unfortunately, anybody with bone cancer as a secondary cancer, it is awful. It's terrible. Like, I couldn't imagine. I remember one lady, she just literally coughed and she fractured four ribs. The nurse came in, they tried to change her bed sheets a bit and she fractured her femur because the bones become so brittle. It's just, yeah, it's terrible, terrible. Pain can also be the result of treatments. You know, surgery causes pain, radiation can cause pain, chemotherapy can cause pain. Right? Side effects to all these things are absolutely horrible in some cases. That's where I had a buddy in the winter. He had colon cancer, or rectal cancer, actually, and he had to have a resection done in his rectum. and as part of his treatment, because it was stage four, I believe it was, stage three or stage four. So, of course, they did the surgery. They removed the tumor. He had an ostomy for quite a period of time while the area was healing. But they put him on a particular chemotherapy because they felt there might have been metastases in the body. So he was on a chemo that, dealt with any particular cancer cells that might be anywhere in the body. The side effect was it was cold. Everything was cold. Even a cold drink hurt going down his throat. So he tried curling. So we actually had he had like battery powered socks and gloves. I tried to keep his hands warm. Even this cold would be painful to him. So a cold drink was painful. He actually had pain down his throat when he was drinking. And it was all because of the chemotherapy. So there can be some weird side effects to a lot of different chemos. Cold here now, isn't it? mild to moderate superficial pain can include hypertension, tachycardia, and tachypnea, which is, of course, faster breathing. So you've got high blood pressure, you've got fast heart rate, and you're faster breathing. In severe or visceral pain, you can get hypotension, so a parasympathetic response. Blood pressure goes down, blood rate goes down, the individual expresses nausea, vomiting, tachypnea, which again can result in faster breathing, weakness or fainting, all from stimulation of the parasympathetic nervous system. Compression of the spinal cord may manifest as radicular pain. So if they have a spinal tumor, whatever level that tumor is kind of affecting can result in a radicular pattern, which I'm sure you guys have all talked about in assessment class, right? More in neuro. So straight leg raise, right? Slump tests. You guys have done all those. What semester are you guys in? Oh, it's three. I keep thinking you guys are in four. Right, I was thinking you did the first one. So those are tests that you're going to learn where we deliberately challenge the nerve. So you've been learning lots of tests to challenge muscle tissue and soft tissue, right? Well, if we think we have something that's called radicular pain, that is if a particular level of the spinal cord or the nerve root is affected. So you guys have done dermatomes and myotomes, right? Okay. So imagine, if you will, if I have a tumor that's compressing at the L5 level, it's conceivable that that pain could be expressed in the myotome or the dermatome at that level on that side that's being compressed, right? Do you remember what L5 is? Not quite. That's S1. L5. Right there, that way, yes. Because S1 is actually right at the great toe and between the two metatarsals, right? What's that? So a spinal tumor presses on the nerve and they may express pain distally just like that, right? Presence of jaundice with atypical back pain may indicate obstruction of hepatobiliary and or liver metastases. So they've got back pain and they're going jaundice. That might be an expression that there's something going on with the liver. It's not functioning properly, or the biliary part of the liver with the gallbladder and so forth, where they end up with metastases in the liver. Pain management can depend on underlying etiology. Pain approaches also depend on acute versus chronic. It could include, but not limited to, opioids, non-opioids, chemotherapy, radiation, or both, surgery or nerve blocks. So whenever we think of pain control, we always think of opioids and non-opioids. But it could be we use chemotherapy or radiation to shrink the tumor, which will get rid of some of the pain, right? So it can be used in pain management to some degree, or surgery. Take the friggin' thing out, whatever, and then hopefully whatever it's compressing will be not compressed. Opioids, lots of talk about opioids, right? Morphine, hydromorphone, fentanyl, and oxycodone. I have had fentanyl. Oh, my goodness. Sorry? No, I had a supraspinatus repair, and in the recovery room, she gave me literally... in the syringe, could barely see it. Yeah, I was like, wow.
It's really short half-life, though. You're only even.
Yeah, I was pretty toasted on that stuff. I couldn't believe it. It was so I can't imagine using a regulator with a patch or something what it must do to you, because it's powerful stuff. I couldn't get over it. I couldn't get over how much it was. But I was so it altered me so much that my daughter made me a cup of tea when she got me home, and I thought it was the best freaking cup of tea I ever had in my life. opioid rotation is common. So because they don't want to get stuck on one, at times they will rotate through them in terms of pain management where it's being changed. Non-pharmacologics can include massage, simple touch, acupuncture, imagery, reflexology, and relaxation training. They can be used to deal with procedural pain. They can also be used to reduce depression, anxiety, and fear as well. Massage, it's interesting, there's a whole part in the book on massage. It says, modality is increasing in its use for pain and symptom relief. There still exists a debate in regards to those with lymphedema or at risk for developing lymphedema. So when I went to school and I took massage therapy, cancer was a contradiction. You could not treat someone with cancer. Because the thoughts were, by promoting lymph drainage, I could in fact be promoting metastases. Right? Now, we're still not sure if that happens, but we also know that, you know, research still shows that it's safe, but those with cancer may be at a higher risk for adverse events. And I don't know if you guys talk about this in your standards, but direct pressure over a tumor would be locally contraindicated. You would not massage directly over a tumor if you knew where a tumor was. Okay? It is best shown to reduce stress and anxiety, helps with constipation. There's lots of research on increasing T cells or immune response with massage. All right, so if they're, you know, they're on chemotherapy drugs that are reducing their immunity, massage is shown to bring some of those cells up, the numbers of them, in the immune response. Promote postoperative healing and reduce scar formation. But of course, as we know, modifications may be required depending on how the patient presents, right? Neuropathic pain is due to nerve damage, can be caused by tumor invasion, or as a side effect from a cytotoxic drug therapy. All right, so, you know, this cold feeling that my friend had, some people get pain patterns, all sorts of weird things, because the chemo is doing things to it. Conventional analgesics do not always provide relief to neuropathic pain. So, could be infrared light treatment sometimes works, antidepressant drugs, anti-epileptics sometimes work, and sometimes steroids work. And they will use these to try to get as much relief for the patient as at all possible. Pain relief is not immediate in the case of these treatments. And these kind of treatments, the drugs especially, the antidepressants, anti-epileptics, or steroids, they have to be taken continuously in order to have any effect. They can't be just once in a while. Physical agents. Can I borrow a book? Because I thought this was kind of interesting. Sorry, I forgot to bring my book with me. Thank you. We're doing Thomas. Good. So it's a couple things in here. So it's a box written by a therapist, a PT, but still, it's still physical work. It's talking about muscle stim and that kind of stuff, right? And there's very limited evidence regarding the use of modalities at a site distant from the primary location of the cancer. Although the mechanism of action of most physical agents suggests that their use may be safe if the agents are not used over an area where cancer is present. Because of the nature of cancer to metastasize to other areas, the clinician cannot know with certainty where the cancer is or is not. Because the problem is, if I'm going to do research to say, if I use a muscle stim, will that induce metastases? So we'll take a group of you, you've all got cancer, half of you will get muscle stim and half of you won't. Well, that's unethical. Because if it does cause metastases, you guys are all doomed, right? So we'll never really know for sure whether or not it actually does, because there's no way to have any kind of research to suggest that it does. So one exception made to the contraindications for using physical agents in patients with a history of cancer is during hospice or palliative care, where the priority is patient comfort and control over survival. In such circumstances, physical agents may provide pain relief with fewer and less severe side effects than medications and are sometimes used in the place of, to supplement, or to allow lower doses of analgesic medications. So in the palliative patient, you could consider the indication because the outcome is going to be death anyways in the patient because of where they're at, okay? Cancer-related fatigue is something more common you may run into, also known as CRF. It is a persistent and subjective sense of tiredness or exhaustion related to cancer or cancer treatment that is not proportional to recent activity and interferes with functionability. So it's significant fatigue. Fatigue is the universal symptom in all people receiving chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and biologic response modifiers. These are biologic drugs that are made from living cells and are used to kill cancer cells to stop them from growing. Universal symptom in all people. So people that are getting treated for cancer are going to have significant fatigue. So we have to consider that. Yes, do you have a question? Yes, usually the treatment. It's like, I don't know, has anybody here ever been in an oncology department when it's time for someone to get chemotherapy? Imagine you've got cancer. You're sitting in a Jerry chair, right? You've got the IV in. It's time for your chemo. The nurse walks in a hazmat suit, a lead vest, thick rubber gloves, a mask to take that chemotherapy because it's so toxic. And then they put it in your body. So the nurse is actually so protected, and you're lying there, and they're putting that raid in there. It really depends. What's that?
Yeah,
it really depends on the chemo. So it's not that they directly put the whole thing into you. They have a side bag to the IV, and it would drip in accordingly. Some treatments can take 3 or 4 hours. Some can take 6 hours. It really depends on the different chemos that you have. But ultimately, it's poison. Radiation, we can get radiation down to the smallest beam, but it's still indiscriminate in terms of what it's going through. So I said my father-in-law had prostate cancer, and he had a prostatectomy, but they also wanted to do radiation in the area. So he had to go in and have a tattoo. And the tattoo represented, through radiography, they figured out where his skeletal structures were, and they placed the tattoo, literally the size of a nothing, so that they knew where the best place was to put the beam of radiation to avoid any bone and get down into the area where the prostate was. Well, guess what? He's bowel incontinent, because as it passed through, it destroyed nerves in the mesentery, and part of the bowel now is spastic, and he can't control his bowels, and he has to wear a diaper, just from, literally, pencil lead thin beam of radiation.
No, actual.
That depends on what you have, because they still do beams too, depending on how bad your cancer is. So there, you can see why fatigue is, because this stuff is like, it's not conducive to life, right? You guys never met Rob. Rob was a teacher here for a long time. He was a chiropractor, really smart guy. He used to teach paths all the time. The future will come where we will look back and look at the barbaric 20th and 21st century, how we poisoned people with chemicals and radiation to cure cancer. How have we ever thought that was okay? Because we'll come up with lots of other ways to be able to deal with cancer. But they're very detrimental to our existence. Up to 30% of cancer survivors report loss of energy for years after the cessation of treatments. I read a very good article in the paper this past summer. We say that patients beat cancer. You don't. You have the effects of cancer pretty much all your life. Doesn't mean you're dysfunctional. It just means you're always left with something, a scar, a removal, something that that's left behind that you carry with you from being a cancer survivor. This is an outcome measurement tool. I'm sure you've talked about those. Yes. I thought I came across that. That'd be kind of cool. Maybe you want to print this off for yourself and maybe use it in clinic. It actually is a symptom assessment for for this the CRF. So these are questions that you would ask as an outcome measurement tool to see how much fatigue your patient actually has from. You guys have talked about these, haven't you? Outcome measurement tools?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of them. Okay. All right. We're a little behind, but we're not too bad. We should have been in integumentary today, but that's okay. So.